Welcome back. So to review this morning a little bit. There's the practice of asking oneself, is awareness present? At the time of sitting, or at the time of standing, time of walking, the time of lying down, at the time of eating, at the time of talking, one could ask, as if one doesn't know the answer, is awareness present right now? Not in a kind of theoretical way, but like not like is awareness present in general, but is awareness present right now? Now is a key part of this. And again, this awareness doesn't mean like am I concentrated? Am I being mindful? This is more like is there a knowing? Is there experiencing going on right now? Even if it's totally distracted. Experience? Is there experiencing? To ask and look. In order to answer the question, where would you say that you look? Where do you go or look to answer the question experientially? So one said, body, but the body, I would say, is an experience. The body is physical sensations, physical tactile sensations. So now we have the body, awareness of the body. Awareness of the, and we could say, is there awareness of the body? And where do we go to see if there's awareness of the body? Mind. Depends what we mean by mind, I suppose. But if we mean awareness, is awareness present? Where do we go to answer the question? We go to awareness. You could say mind. And does that make sense? That in a way we're so used to, you know, there's mindfulness of body and mindfulness of breathing and mindfulness of feeling and mindfulness of mental states and so on. So here we're, those are all called objects of experience. Sometimes we don't think of them that way. They're called experiences. The body, for us, in our direct experience, what is the body? It's an experience. That's what it, I mean, for us, isn't that what the body is? Sometimes it's a conceptual experience, like the body means it's a bunch of limbs and organs put together. That's a conceptual idea. But in our direct experience, it's these physical sensations, right? Called, that come and go. They're experiences. So we're asking, is there an awareness of these experiences? Yeah, it's like, it's always a stepping back from the experience, even of the body. And somebody said, where do we go? Somebody said, everywhere. In a way, we could say, everywhere is kind of like nowhere. And I think that everywhere and nowhere are accurate in the sense that we don't go to some particular location to answer the question. Is awareness present? Where do you go? I go to like the back of my skull or something. Like, no, we don't go to the back of the skull, right? We don't go to any location. Any location is an experience. What is experiencing this sense of location? In a way, that's also a way I think of talking about the body. The body is a sense of locatedness, a tactile sense of locatedness in space, like the sense of body is around here for, you know, in this experience. And, you know, your sense of body might be over there. It's locatedness. That means it's an experience in space, and it's experience right now means like in time. So anything that happens in time and space is an experience. And what is it that's aware of a particular intersection of time and space, God the body or feeling? Awareness is aware of time and space experiences. And awareness, or experiencing, I would propose, is not located in time and space. It has no location. Where is awareness happening? I think it's to say everywhere, I think is okay. But everywhere, like, or also to say it's nowhere is also okay. But it's definitely not some particular place rather than any other particular place. It's definitely, people often say it's here. That's not my experience. Except my conceptual experience, because we've heard that the brain that's in the skull has something to do with awareness, but that's just what we've been taught by biologists. It has nothing to do with my experience, except that it's so ingrained an idea now that I feel like awareness is somehow located around the head. Because the sense organs are gathered in this location in space, so it feels as if then awareness is located here, but this sense of location, that of eyes and ears and so on, is being experienced by an awareness that has no location. Can you kind of follow this?
Now, the problem with the question is that we're immediately when you make the question, you mislead, you know, because where do we go?
Uh-huh.
To look for,
yeah.
There's all kinds of implied agents and
So it's already, if you start to really examine the question, it's kind of complicated. But you could say attention. Attention is what's moving around towards all experiences. Attention is directed towards a sensation in the knee. Then a bird sings, and attention goes out towards the bird. Then somebody coughs and the attention goes there. Then the light shines through the window and the attention goes there. The attention is like a kind of beam of light that's directed towards the kind of dominant experience. You could say, now we're like paying attention to awareness itself. That beam of light that's like called attention that's going towards these different experiences, where does it... Where you can take I out of this and say, where does that beam of light, where does it aim to answer this question, is awareness present? It would have to aim at awareness, right? But awareness is no location. So the light beam doesn't go anywhere. There isn't some special trick answer to this, but it's worth looking. Like, where does awareness go? Sometimes there's a sense of, like, it's a backwards, Dogen calls it the backwards step. And I think that's just because the light beam that's aiming towards experiences is usually directed frontwards. I think because of our sense organs are directed frontwards. The light beam is going out here, and now it's like, it's back. This reminds me of Douglas Harding. You know, Douglas Harding has his book on having no head. And very similar exercise, very creative way of talking about it. He says, you get into like, you know, what's that? It's the floor. What's that? It's a chair. What's that? It's a ceiling. You follow the end of your fingers like the light beam of your attention. What's that? What's that? It's a person. Now, what's that? In your direct experience, don't say face because you don't see a face, right? What is that? And actually, if you really, you know, stay true to your experience, yeah, it's nothing. And that's what he calls the experience of on having no head. We realize that there isn't anything there. And that's his kind of creative way of...
Because if there's a shine out its dark behind the light where it's coming from. Is that one way to look at it? You can never see.
I mean, you could say it's dark, but you could just say it's the source of light, and the source of light is ungraspable. Another way that this turning the light around and shining back, another English translation of that Chinese phrase is tracing back the radiance. One translator translates it Eko Henjo, tracing back the radiance. Instead of turning the light around, it's kind of tracing it back to its source, and its source is unlocated. Yes?
I've heard a reference of Wahara.
Dahara,
I have no idea, but I recently saw something about the second brain and how much of
the gut.
Yeah, I get the point.
Well, anyway, yeah, Ahara is like a...
But how is that explained? Have you heard?
Well, I think the point is, I think it is a good practice when we're breathing, mindfulness of breathing, to put our attention on the Ahara rather than... in the head or something. If we're using a location, it's nice to start with, really get into breathing in the Ahara and mindfulness of breathing down here. But then this practice now is a different practice. We say, now we're paying attention to the breath in the Ahara. What is aware of the breath in the Ahara? Or now, is there awareness of the breath in the Ahara? It's taking a step back from the Ahara. And yes, there definitely, wouldn't we all say, there is awareness of breath in the Ahara when we're paying attention to it. Where is that awareness of the breath in the Ahara? And it's not in the Ahara. It's not anywhere, right? The experience of breath in the Ahara is being experienced by awareness. This is subtle, right? It's distinguishing an experience, a tactile experience in it. In space and in time, from the awareness of that experience that's not happening in any space or in any time. So, I brought up the Jewel Mirror Samadhi this morning, this poem, Zen poem, and I think it's talking about this awareness. And it's describing this awareness, Dongshan, the ancestor who wrote this, said, it's so vast that it transcends dimension. It's so minute, it fits into spacelessness. Or it's so vast, it is utterly beyond location. It's, in other words, it's beyond big. It's so vast. But also, it's so tiny, it's like fits into spacelessness. In other words, this jewel mirror awareness is like... has no size or dimension. That helps us to kind of open to it. What a strange thing, something that has no size or shape or dimension, and yet, we're not talking about some abstract realm that's not happening right now. We're talking about this awareness that we're all sharing. This present awareness is totally ungraspable and at the same time totally undeniable. It can't, and we can't lose it. Even when we think we're totally distracted, there's an awareness of total distraction that never changes as the experience of distraction changes. So you have a question?
You have your hand up? You did. A moment ago.
Not now. So, we can ask this question, is awareness present? Yes. What is it that knows awareness is present? How do we know awareness is present? What is it that knows that awareness is present? Awareness knows that awareness is present. This is being aware of being aware. We could say awareness of awareness, but I think to use nouns like that maybe subtly starts to make awareness into something. But to keep it as a verb, being aware of being aware is a little less graspable. But I would propose this is what's happening right now. There is being aware of being aware. And we can be there, be here for this self-knowing awareness that's already happening. And then, once we're getting used to attending to an unlocated, ungraspable reality, then we can ask further, how big is this awareness? So, it's so vast, it transcends dimension, right? So fine, if it's into spaciousness, it doesn't have a size, which means it doesn't have any boundaries or edges. If to have boundaries or edges, it would have to be some physical size, right? Awareness is not like that. So if it has no edges or boundaries, that means this is pay attention to this line. If it has no edges or boundaries, that means that there's nothing outside of it. It's not a theoretical thing. Check it out in your experience. Anything we're talking about here is experiences, right? So we're like, say we're looking at the wall, or you can look at my face, and like this, that's an experience that seems to be from you, seems to be over here, you know, over there. I'm over here and I'm looking at you over there. I'm looking at the pillar over there. But if the awareness has no edges or boundaries, then it's not actually a pillar, right? It's an experience of a pillar, a visual experience. That sight, that color and shape, that visual object called a pillar, is not somehow outside the awareness. It's within it, isn't it? Experientially? We have to stop and check, isn't it? It's like, the awareness has no edges or boundaries. It's all-inclusive awareness. Everything we see and hear is happening within this space of awareness. That's why another common analogy is space. Awareness is like this boundless space. But here we're talking also about it as light. It's spacious, boundless light that is all-inclusive. Every experience is within it. Can you open to that in your own experience? Doesn't it seem like everything is included? Yeah. Or first there was another question over here. Did you have a question? You want to skip it?
I guess since everyone's looking at me, I'll say it now. when you said that, it made me think of, you know, there's the different levels of samadhi and dhana. How do you say it? Dhana.
Dhyana.
Mm-hmm. There's the one, I think it's the fifth one, it's boundless samadhi, no form and space. It made me think about that.
Yeah, there's boundless space and boundless consciousness are names for some of these dhyanas.
Do you think that's the same thing, or is that a different thing altogether?
It's an interesting question. I think from the point of view of the Buddhist system, I would, even though they sound like the same, I think to make the Buddhist system fit together, which I'm always like to, my conceptual mind likes to do that, then I would say we can't really say it's the same thing, because these dhyanas are these concentration states. They're not the realm of Buddha's enlightenment, but in and of themselves. Even though I agree, they sound like that. So that's maybe for further exploration. It's a good question, though.
Sorry, I told you it was a tangent.
No, not a tangent. Yes.
Well, I was thinking it's tempting to think of it as this, you know, big bowl where everything is happening inside of the bowl.
Yeah, but bigger than big, like
bigger
sizeless
than big,
bowl.
But it's also smaller than small.
That's right.
So,
but it is like
it can't be that.
Yeah, it's a little bit like it feels a little bowl-like. I understand what you mean. Yeah.
But also earlier today, I was thinking, well, it's focusing on the verb,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, experiencing.
But you still can't ignore subject and object entirely.
Well, no, not ignore them.
Yeah.
But now we can say, so now this is a good segue into the next part of this discussion.
Okay.
Thank you for that. So now we have this, do you want a question?
I see awareness or the present as being very elusive. The moment I start thinking about what is awareness or what is the present, I'm no longer in the present moment. So it's...
If you're thinking about it conceptually, I agree, it's very elusive. You can't get a hold of it conceptually. It's so elusive because it's not a thing. It's not something we can get a hold of. And yet, we are present and aware. So, it's like... I think... So we're up to this step where, how big is it? And really to, you know, not just, don't take my word for it, right? You have to confirm for yourself that there is a present awareness right now that has no dimension or size, which means it has no boundaries or edges, which means everything that is being, every experience is arising within the space called experiencing. Everyone following so far? So then we can take something and a visual experience, like you can look at the noble goddess Prajnaparamita, mother of all Buddhas. This is a very beautiful figure on the altar. I assume it's Prajnaparamita.
It is.
Yeah, amazing. You can look at her. And or anything, just to take a visual experience, and then the question is, while you're don't stray back into your usual way of looking and thinking, but being this space, this luminous space of awareness, and looking at her, you are the space of awareness now, right? Remember, we're calling it the capital S. Self, sometimes. Just, that's not something that's happening to you, the person. You are the awareness, right? So how far away from you is Prajnaparamita on the altar? So one said 10 feet. So that's right. What happens is then we revert back to, I am this body and mind and an I faculty. But remember, you are not an I organ or a body. You are the unlocated space of awareness. You have to stay in this reality realm, right? There's a body and a mind. We don't deny that there's seeing going on in body and mind, but you're not the head or the body. You are the unlocated space of awareness, right? So how far away from you is Goddess Prajnaparamita on the altar?
Not far.
Well, how far?
Infinitely far.
So infinitely far and not far. Which one is correct?
There is no wrong.
Well, we're talking about distance.
There's no location.
No distance. There's no distance between you and... this Prajnaparamita. No distance is another way of saying no separation. Like, literally, we're not talking like metaphorically or theoretically. Can you actually experientially tap into that? Isn't that beautiful?
It's like the melding of the boundaries around my experience and the melding of the boundaries around what my eyes see.
Yeah. And I think it's very easy to then fall back into, because we're very used to thinking, I am this body and these eyes. But remember, Buddha said from the very earlier teachings, this body is not myself. That's not really, we don't deny that there is a body in this case. We're just saying, this body is not really who I am. And even dualistic consciousness is is the mind that arises dependent on an object where there's a separate subject and object. That's not who I am. But the ever-present, unlocated experiencing. Later the Buddha said, there is a self, it's called Buddha nature, and it's who we really are. So if we stay with that, and then we look at things and say, how far away are they from me? We have to remember who I am, right? I am the boundless space. And it's you could say, that's just a creative visualization. I'm just imagining that I'm the space of awareness. But hopefully by this point you can start to open to, it's not just a creative visualization. That actually is who I am. I mean, who I am, meaning like, the self is what's always present, what's, you know, who I most intimately feel myself to be. When I feel myself to be this body and mind, there's already a little bit of tension because I'm separate and something might attack me and all that. So this is an exercise you can try out again and again. How far away is that visual object? And now remember, there's all these different knowing or awareness can take these forms of, we're talking about seeing here, but trying out with hearing. So you're hearing this voice, is this dominant sound. How far away from you is the sound of the voice? Again, you could say, it's 10 feet away, but that's 10 feet from your ear, from the ear of a body. But from you, the knowing space of awareness, there's no distance, right? The sound is no distance. There's no separation between you, between me and the sound. It's almost now as if this bowl-like, boundless bowl-like, bubble-like, but not, but space-like, really. That's why all these are just, these words are hinting at, and bowl has an edge or boundary, right? And we might feel that the bowl ends at the walls here, but remember the walls are not any distant from this. It's really a boundless space. Try out this way of looking at your present experience. This boundless space is permeated, like infused or permeated with colors and shapes and visual experiences. It's like an empty space, but it's completely permeated three-dimensionally by color and shape. Right? And at the same time, it's permeated by colors and shapes, it's permeated by sound. Like this sound seems to be filling the entire space of awareness, unlocatedly. The sound is filling the space. And tactile sensations, bodily sensations, you might notice your butt on a cushion or something like this, or gurgling stomach. Notice how you can also relate to these bodily sensations are also kind of permeating this boundless space. And the bodily, how far away from you, remember who you are, right? How far away from you is the tension in the stomach? Or, you know, whatever your dominant bodily sensation is. I'll feel some bodily, some tactile sensation. How far away from you, the awareness, is the bodily sensation? It's maybe even more intimate than color and sound.
Do we think that way? The pain in my stomach, do we think that's a distance from me?
Oh, well, that's a good question. You mean when we're in our usual thinking and our everyday thinking, It seems to me sometimes we might think, again, that I am more located in the head. Unconsciously, I think it was a good point that our sense faculties are mostly located in the head. But the fifth sense, called the body sense, is not just in the head, that's through the whole body. But sometimes it feels like I'm up here and I'm experiencing a stomach sensation 3 feet from me. I'm in the head. Sometimes I think I've sometimes experienced like that. It's a delusion. but isn't that weird? Or, you know, that, Yeah, we get confused about ourself as the body. We feel like the stomach is a particular location in time and space. It is, actually, right? That any sensation is. But the knowing of that sensation is boundless. And it's almost as if this is something to explore, a really great one in meditation with the body, with feeling bodily sensations, is like as if there's this vast knowing space that's, as I said, permeated by sensations, but it's not like, it's almost like they're unlocated when we tap into the space like knowing. It's like the suddenly the stomach, sensation in the stomach, is it the lower part of experiencing or the upper part of experiencing? Experiencing doesn't have an upper and lower part. Experiencing, right, is boundless and all pervasive. And yet, you could say the locatedness, the sense of locatedness in the stomach, is an experience. So locations are known by this unlocated knowing. But, so if you've been following this, maybe you can come to see how this is a way of talking about non-separation. It really experiential non-separation. You could say, isn't this just a mental trick or something? But is this not like our most intimate experience? And maybe really the mental trick is what dualistic consciousness does when thinking, actually, I am this limited body and mind, separate experience called Kokyo, that's separate from everybody else, and that's who I am, and therefore how far away is Jim from me? There he's 5 feet away from me. We're separate. If I'm the body and mind and sense faculties, then we're inherently separate, and we can still be good friends, but and we can be interdependent, but we're not like one. This is the realm of in this awareness, it's not the realm of interdependence, actually. It's the realm of we are one awareness. And you could say, but does that mean we share the same mind? We don't share the same dualistic consciousness. We don't read each other's thoughts most of the time. But you could say we're not talking about our dualistic consciousnesses. We're talking about this boundless space. And if you say, well, we must have different Buddha natures, we must have different boundless spaces. If it's boundless, then that means it's all inclusive.
So is that mind the mind of any mind? Or the awareness?
If we're talking about this boundless awareness, then you could say we share this Buddha nature literally. Like you could say there's one Buddha nature. I mean, maybe it's not exactly right to say one because one is relative to two, but there aren't multiple Buddha natures. I think it's okay. It's closer to say that there's one. And in Zen, they start using this phrase, the one mind, like that Zen ancestor Huang Bo in old China famously said, all Buddhas, all awakened Buddhas, and all deluded sentient beings are just this one mind, outside of which nothing exists, or apart from which nothing exists. So therefore, that sounds like we really are one mind here, I understand, is the boundless awareness of Buddha nature, not dualistic consciousness, not even the storehouse consciousness. We have individual storehouses with all our past karmic tendencies. That's, you could say, a kind of individual. But if we said within this boundless awareness, there's, it's divided up into different subsections called me and you, then we said, well, where's the division between my Buddha nature and your Buddha nature? We'd say it's exactly between our bodies, you know. And if we say that there's a division there, this, I know it sounds absurd, but we'd say if we found any kind of division, that division is called an experience. It's, The vision is a conceptual experience, or even if we feel like we sense it somehow, it's an experience. And you can say, what is experiencing this thing called a division? Experiencing is, awareness is. And awareness is inherently indivisible, because a division is just another object of awareness. We can explore this deeply. Many questions should come up around this kind of thing, because it's so unusual. There's one right now.
So I see in personalizing awareness, or personalizing Buddha nature, I am at that moment creating a space. And so
or a division, you mean?
Or a division.
Yeah. When personalizing Buddha nature, it creates a kind of a division between me and you. Yeah, I agree.
And awareness, I am awareness, awareness is me. I am Buddha nature is me. And trying to move away and maybe go in the direction of depersonalizing.
Yeah.
And then thereby not creating a separation, more of a union.
Yeah, a shared reality. And still, so most intimately, what we share this awareness, we could say, but it still appears as that as a body, you're over there and I'm over here, we're 5 feet apart. That's the appearance of bodies. We don't deny that. And so we say, what about subjects and objects in this realm of boundless awareness? We don't deny subjects and objects, but we say they're just appearances. Objects are just appearances, manifestations, sometimes in the Buddha nature tradition, and Dogen like really loves this word manifestation. All things are manifestations of Buddha mind. In other words, awareness is taking the form of appearances called objects, and also awareness manifests or takes the form of appearances called subjects. You could say, and then they have a particular relationship to subjects and objects, and the relationship between subjects and objects is called dualistic consciousness, is what mediates between a subject and an object in the Buddhist teaching. So dualistic consciousness is another appearance, a manifestation of awareness. Awareness can manifest as dualistic consciousness, which in fact it does all the time. That's why it seems like I can quickly shift back into, I'm over here and you're over there. That's called dualistic consciousness. And the Buddha says, that's not yourself. That's not myself. That's a dualistic consciousness. But the undivided awareness, he never says, that's not ourself. So going back to Changsha's saying from this morning, the Chinese ancestor Changsha said, the entire universe in 10 directions. We've been talking about pillars and statues on the altar. We can expand it to the entire universe of experiences in the 10 directions, all colors, sounds, any possible experience throughout the entire universe. The entire universe in 10 directions is the radiant light of the self, Changsha says. And he says, the entire universe in the 10 directions is within the radiant light of the self. Just another way of, you know, meditating on this point. Everything's happening within this big space. In the entire universe in 10 directions, there's not a single person who is not myself. And that's the real clincher, I think. That's the real, like, if we can access that in our life, which admittedly is challenging because of our habits of dualistic thought, then we can, like, you know, be talking to each other, and we're not just interdependent, but you are me and I am you. It's like one awareness is manifesting as two different people, and they can talk with each other in an interdependent way, But the interdependent way is like a, it's like the movie characters on the screen of this boundless movie. And we say, that's the teaching of dependent co-arising, is all the movie characters are interacting with each other interdependently. But meanwhile, all the whole movie is happening on this unchanging screen of awareness. And you could say the true nature of Jim is just the screen, and the true nature of Kokyo is just the screen. There's actually, we are one screen, but there's also an interdependent movie playing out on the screen. Follow that one.
Beatles song. I am you, he is me, we are all together.
Yeah. Like that. Question? Yeah.
The concept, unbounded awareness that you've been talking about.
Yeah, boundless.
That more boundless awareness. Is that just another way of describing another Buddhist term, which is emptiness? Is it the same thing?
Some people, like me, would agree with that. And there are, for example, the Lankavatara Sutra, the Buddha's teaching this Buddha nature. In Sanskrit, it's called Tathagata Garbha, like the womb or the heart, the essence of the Buddha. And in that sutra, the Buddha says, sometimes I teach this Tathagata Garbha with the word shunyata, or emptiness. And sometimes I call it signlessness. And sometimes I call it anatman, not self. But then in other sutras, sometimes I call it atman, self. Yeah, the Lankavatara never uses the term, it is our true self. In that sutra, the Buddha doesn't use that term, but the Nirvana Sutra, then he calls it the true self. But he does call it, yeah, in the Lankavatara, he says, I mean, these sutras, sometimes they're taught to different people at different times. So the Lankavatara Sutra, a bodhisattva comes to the Buddha and says, this Buddha nature that you're teaching sounds just like the self of the other Indian philosophers. It sounds like the Atman of the Tirthikas, the Atman of these non-Buddhists. Sounds a lot like that to me, Buddha. And the Buddha says, no, it's not the same. Because actually, it's emptiness, signlessness, and they don't talk about it like that. So, and then later, when you asked, is it that Atman? The Buddha said, yeah, yeah, it is. So it just depends on context, you know?
Would you say for you, oneness and emptiness are synonymous terms?
That oneness?
And emptiness are synonymous terms.
Oneness and emptiness? Yeah, I think for today's discussion, the unity, oneness is like indivisibility. Maybe that's, but it's nice, the Buddha always likes talking in negatives, like emptiness of any graspable thing, right? Is it kind of a negative term? And maybe we'd say oneness might be slightly graspable for some people. So to say undividedness is a little less graspable, but same as oneness. One just means undivided or non-dual, right? That's, we say non-duality is a, you could say a synonym for oneness, but it's, to say non-duality is like, well, how do you grasp that? But if it's oneness, we might say, we'll package it all up into like big bowl, grasp the bowl of oneness. Non-duality is a great term, not two. Oh, yes, you have the mic, so.
I was thinking, though, that if I am you and you are me, you know, like there's no duality. Still, if the pain is going on in your stomach, it's hard for me to feel that.
Yeah. Yeah, you wouldn't, right? Because that's an experience. The experiences are the workings of the separate consciousnesses. I think it's fair to say Well, have you noticed, I'm distinguishing these terms, awareness as boundless, all-inclusive, unified, non-dual knowing that we all share, called Buddha nature. And if we want to get technical, I would say that's a nice translation for the Sanskrit word jnana. Jnana means knowing or undivided knowing or awareness. And then there's another Sanskrit term, vijnana, that means, we usually translate it as consciousness in Buddhism, that means like divided knowing, that's divided into an apparent subject and object. It appears to be divided into subject and object. You could say the subject's a manifestation of Buddha nature, the object's a manifestation of Buddha nature, and the consciousness is a manifestation of Buddha nature. And so we have different consciousnesses, and so therefore we don't experience each other's thoughts and feelings and so on. But the knowing of your thoughts, you could say, is the same knowing of my thoughts. But the cause and effect kind of thing here, the setup in the human realm, seems to be that even if the knowing is the same, the knowing as it operates through that body and mind knows the experiences of that body and mind, and the same knowing that operates kind of as this body and mind knows the experiences of this body and mind. Seems like that's how it works around here. So it could be that there are stories of actually being able to know other people's minds. It's part of the Mahayana story of the Buddha, and you might not like this kind of story because it's too far out. But it is part of the tradition is that this Buddha is sarva jnana. It's the same jnana means undivided knowing, and sarva means all knowing. Usually it's translated as omniscient. And that's a quality in the Mahayana teachings of the Buddha. It's not my experience as Kokyo, but the more open to this reality, what seems to be in our own experience, this reality of Buddha nature, the more it seems that anything is possible, anything could be possible here in this all-knowing knowing. So there's another Zen story that I think points this out very nicely too. Yun Men, who's another Chinese ancestor, once said to the assembly, "Everyone has a radiant light." Same term that Changsha uses, komyo, radiant light. Everyone has this radiant light, or everyone is this radiant light, you could translate it as. But when you look for it, you don't see it. It's dark and obscure. Right, so we've been talking about this, right? It kind of makes sense. Everyone is this radiant light, but when you look for it as an experience, when you look for it as an object, right, you can't see it as a thing. It's dark and obscure. If you try to get a hold of it, that kind of looking for it. Right? Everyone is just radiant light, but when you look for it as something, you don't see it, and it just seems to be dark and obscure. And then Yun Men says, "What is everyone's radiant light?" And nobody answers. So he answers on their behalf and says, "The Zendo, the Buddha hall, the kitchen, and the temple gate." So when you look for this light of awareness as something, you don't see it. But everything that you see is it. See how this story, you can really, I think, is very straightforward. There's nothing mystical about this story, I don't think. If we from this new perspective, right? Everyone has a light, everyone is this light. When you look for it as something, you don't see the light as something in yourself or in your body or some sort of glowing something. What is this light? everything that you see poetically, the Zendo, the Buddha hall, the kitchen, the gate, the tree, the house, the car, the dog, everything that you hear, the bird sound, the voice, the cough, the jackhammer, everything that you taste, smell, touch, that is the light, right? It's the radiant light of awareness is manifesting as every experience. Can you follow that?
You look for it, it's like trying to look at your own eyeball.
Yeah, it's like trying to look at your own eyeball. But then, so we're kind of looking back for something, like, where's the light? I can't see it. Everything that we see is it, right? When we say, the way to access that, how far away from you the awareness is Prajnaparamita? No distance. That means she is you, right? She literally, it's awareness taking the form of color or sound or statue. And another way to say this I find really helpful is, can you find, say, like looking at Prajnaparamita statue, right? Can you find the statue other than the knowing of the statue, you know, other than the seeing of the statue? Before we examine, we think, yeah, I see the statue, there's a statue over there, and I see the statue. They're two different things, right? But can you find some statue other than the seeing of the statue? There is definitely the seeing of the statue, but can you find, in addition to the seeing of the statue, is there some extra statue? We think often that we think there is, but again, experientially, we'll never find one of those. So therefore, can you follow that? A mental picture of a statue. Like if we close our eyes, we can visualize Prajnaparamita. And again, we could say, how far away from me the awareness is this mental image? No distance. Well, is that mental image something other than the knowing of the mental image? Is the mental image something other than the awareness of the image? We might say, it must be. We think so deeply that it is, right? So this is nice to do when we're really settled in Zazen to investigate this way, right? Can we find anything other than experiencing? Now, I've been talking about there's experiences, which is visual, you know, colors, like, and statues, and thoughts, and feelings, and sounds. Those are experiences, and then there's the experiencing of them. But now the question is, can we find any experience other than the experiencing of it? In other words, is there such thing as an experience other than just experiencing? There must be an experience, but that's called dualistic consciousness. If we just say, there's just the awareness taking the form of what we call an experience, but that experience is nothing other than the awareness of it. Can you follow? It's just the awareness of it. So there isn't anything other than awareness in this realm. Everything is awareness, but awareness takes the form of colors and sounds and so on. It manifests in these ways.
Is this pure cognition?
You could call it that. Really pure. Cognition meaning like, cognition I think is another word for knowing. And pure in Buddhism is a word for non-dual, actually. Impure cognition would be like the sense that there's an I over here looking at a color over there. It's kind of that's called dualistic consciousness. And as we were talking at lunch, we were talking about this one Buddhist system talks about all these eight consciousnesses, these eight vijñanas are transformed at enlightenment into these jnanas. The divided knowings are is transformed into wisdoms, but actually it's the vijnanas are transformed into jnanas. So how do you transform a vijnana into a jnana? You don't actually change it into a jnana, you just take away the vi. And the vi is the illusion of division, right? So I like this, they talk about transformation of the basis and so on, but I think one Dharma teacher I really appreciate says, it's not, strictly speaking, a transformation. It's just a realization that there never really was consciousness. It's an illusion. Dualistic vijnanas are delusions. And even in the very early teachings of the Buddha, in the twelvefold chain of causation, with the cessation of consciousness, there's the cessation of contact, right? It's like, the cessation of consciousness, that sounds like death. Buddha didn't say it's death. But there's no more vijnana. He didn't say there's no jnana. Yes. Microphone? Oh, there's one.
Thank you. One thing, coming back to the statue concept too, that came up was, even if you were to point to the statue, you're pointing to part of the statue, the knee, the head.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you investigate that further, it goes down and down deeper and deeper into whatever you want to think about it. But that's still not the statue. You still point to just a leg, an arm, a head. They're non-statues combined into make a non-things can't be combined to make a thing. And that was a practice I've tried for a few years and looked into, and this kind of idea, and that really helped.
That's
well.
A little bit of a different approach, right? It's a good one. Another Dharma approach is like kind of analyzing and deconstructing the objects or the experiences. But in this case, you're looking at there's a little nice shift of exercise, right? Which maybe ends up in the same place. You're looking at the statue and you could say, which is closer to me, the knee of the statue or the elbow of the statue? Hmm. And it's a different kind of reasoning. We're saying they're all equidistant. It doesn't matter what part of the statue that you look at.
True.
And whether it's one whole solid seeming statue or a bunch of parts, in both cases, it's a little bit different reasoning here, right? We're saying here we're talking about the statue is nothing other than awareness. Whereas your logic is more like, let's put aside awareness and just look at how the mind constructs holes out of parts.
Yeah.
And so they both start leading the same way, but they're different methods.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Similar to how one other one I be looking back on is reflection, mirror, and you're looking at a reflection of yourself. You never actually see yourself. You always see reflections. And everyone else may see you, I don't know, but that's kind of what I thought about it too. It was, you're always seeing a reflection of yourself. So just fascinating thoughts that, it's been a while since I really kind of dive deep into these again, so it's just kind of coming up with things that I've had in my mind that I just wanted to share.
So. Yeah, so reflection, like a mirror reflection, I think is another great, in a way I would say like kind of a metaphor, analogy for what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And it's a great one because it's kind of like, it's the same metaphor really as the movie one that I mentioned, which I think you could say it's awareness is this boundless mirror, and it's, there's only one mirror in this realm. But on the surface, this mirror is manifesting images of 7 billion people on this planet, and each of them has their own story and so on. But the true nature of each of those reflections is this mirror, one mirror they all share. And you could say the way that this realm of unity is not the realm of dependent co-arising, interdependence. It's the realm of total unity, oneness. But if we want to talk about dependent co-arising, which is an amazing teaching in itself, You could say that's the way that the reflections on the mirror are arising dependent on the other reflections. But it's kind of like this is sort of a level, a stepping back from beneath dependent arising, which is dependent arising appearances. What are these dependent arising appearances? They are just one mind. They're one awareness. So it's kind of like it's the ultimate truth of the, all the interdependent reflections is, in this case, their being Buddha nature. And therefore, we also say, what about inanimate beings, Buddha nature? Usually we say it's the potential to become a Buddha, so all sentient beings are this Buddha nature, because we have minds and awareness. We don't say in Buddhism that rocks have awareness, but we, as we're looking at pillars and bricks and stuff, we're saying they are nothing but awareness. That's different than saying they have some kind of mind. But I think it's fair to say they are. Like when I say my, when I'm looking at them, we say they are my Buddha nature, they are my awareness. Does that make sense? It's one way of talking about the teaching of the insentient or the non-sentient beings being Buddha nature. But we never project some sort of anthropomorphizing, saying they have some kind of subtle mind. They don't have some subtle mind. Maybe we even say we don't have some kind of mind. Mind is actually an illusion, but we say sentient beings are defined by like the illusion of mind, but really everything is just, in this model, everything is just manifestations of that ocean of Buddha nature.
Our discussion today, though, is one side of the two-sided coin, which is you're delving into the absolute truth side of the coin. Because we've been talking about how the pillar is just, everything is just awareness. But awareness could be very dangerous, right? If you walk into a street and you say, how far is that Mack truck from you? You know, so we've had this discussion in our study group before. Mm-hmm. But that's the other side of the coin. Mm-hmm. The relative truth is
another. So for one thing, I think that example is we don't have to worry too much because we this dualistic conscious thing, dualistic consciousness, we have it down. We're not going to step in front of a Mack truck, right? It's not like we'll be entranced by, like, it's no distance from me, boom. It's like we might, you know, try that out or something, but we probably won't because we're really steeped in the dualistic consciousness, which is why we don't have to spend a whole long time saying, please don't step in front of trucks. I mean, yeah, that's one way of looking at it. And then the integration of these two truths, I think you're right, we're emphasizing the ultimate truth is like the mirror, the dual mirror samadhi, right? And then you could say the relative truth is the reflections on the mirror. And I think this makes it a very nice metaphor because that we say the two truths are inseparable. And that's how images are on mirrors, right? You don't say the image is like a little bit apart from the mirror. It's like, in a way, they're one thing. But also you can talk about the mirror and the images. And maybe you can have a mirror without any images in it. But you can't have images without a mirror. But I think it's a beautiful metaphor to reflect on, no pun intended, about the inseparability. It really works well because you can also say that this thing about you're having physical pain in the body, but the awareness of it is not suffering. You can have a very painful reflection happening on the mirror, but the mirror itself is not harmed. And you can have a very great experience, blissful experience in the reflection realm, but the mirror is not benefited. And you can have, that's why Huangbo says, all enlightened Buddhas and all sentient beings are this one mind. It's like, it's not different in Buddhas and different in sentient beings, this mirror. But you could say, what's the difference between the Buddha and the sentient being? A Buddha just knows completely and unceasingly that they are just a mirror, and reflections are nothing but reflections. And a sentient being never even thought that they're just a reflection on a mirror. They just think that, no, I'm like flesh and blood, chunk of stuff. And that's who I am. I am this body and dualistic consciousness and all my habits, and that's who I am. And but it's just a different perception of the same reality. They're both really just made of nothing but the mirror. Okay.
I've just experienced inseparability with you. Did everybody notice me raising my hand? But you didn't. That means that we were inseparable, because you didn't see me and I didn't see you. We was almost not even one.
But we were even before that.
Yes.
And after.
So the entire universe in all directions, and the radiance of light.
The whole universe in 10 directions is the radiant light of the self.
And the radiant light cannot be seen, it cannot be felt, it can only be experienced.
Can't even really be experienced, because once it becomes an experience, then it's something again. So, but there is the experiencing of experiencing, or being aware of being aware. And is that an experience? Not exactly. But this morning I talked about these like letters from emptiness. It's like, wow, yeah, I totally got it. And actually, the body relaxed, and I feel like my problems feel much lighter now. You could say those are like these letters coming from emptiness. You open it up, and it says, you're now relaxed. It's true, yeah, I am. But that's just like the letter, right? Experience. And experience is like a little, like, it's like reality is coming into a we're knowing something from reality, but we package it up. An experience happens in time and space, so it's limited. Maybe, okay, Oscar.
A thought has been kind of knocking in the back of my mind since this afternoon, and I think you kind of touched on it a few minutes ago, but I'd like to maybe circle back around. And it's this memory of Buddha's advice to Bahia in the seeing just the seeing, in the seeing just the seeing, and so forth. And I
when for you in the seeing there will be just the seeing, in the heard there will be just the heard, then there will be no here or there in between, and this will be the end of suffering.
Train yourself this way. So, and I feel strongly that there's some connection between that and what you're laying down, but I'm not quite sure how to elucidate.
Well, our teacher Tenzin Roshi, I remember when we had a little conversation at No Abode a year ago or something, and he was talking about that teaching, and I said, I'm hearing that teaching now as like, instead of all the objects of experience kind of like collapsing into the awareness of them, it's kind of collapsing the awareness into the object. It's really focusing on the object, right? In the scene, there's just the scene. It's maybe what it is like, in all cases, we're trying to collapse duality, the illusion of duality. So I hear this teaching to Bahia as, in the scene, there's just the scene. In other words, the object, there's just the object. There's no subject. So it's like the sense of a separate subject kind of collapses into the object, and it's like object only, right? And then there's other teachings where like the kind of what we've been talking about today is a little bit like the object collapses into not exactly this, maybe in a way, if you say the object collapses into the subject, then there is no subject and object. The subject is just awareness. If there's subject and object rely on each other, and that's duality, the illusion of duality. So what you could say, to dissolve that illusion of duality, you have to bring these two together. And this teaching of in the her, there's just the her, this is the object. So there's just this, means there's no subject observing it. Just color, color, color. There's no, nothing but color. There's no observer.
You are not it, it is you.
Well, that's maybe going another direction too. That would, I mean, that's in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. So I'd say that's, I would say, works nicely with what we've been talking about. You are not this Buddha nature. Buddha nature is you. I would use it, that one there. So that's kind of like, you know, but when we say that the statue on the altar is not out there separate from you, that's kind of like letting the object come into you. And the other one is like, there's the object and you are kind of coming into the object. Does that make sense? It's like they're both about dissolving duality, but they're two different ways.
And an academic question. This is Tathagatagarbha teaching?
Yeah, another name for Buddha nature is Tathagatagarbha. When you hear that term, it means Buddha nature. Or Buddha Dhatu in Sanskrit is maybe the original source for this English term Buddha nature, Chinese term Buddha nature, Buddha Dhatu, the Buddha element. Maybe it's clear. I think lots of questions probably naturally arise with this kind of thing, and we could say, especially a question that could come up is, yeah, I can see how these experiences are the knowing of them, and there's no experience other than the knowing of it. But is this just a mental exercise, a little kind of visualization we can do, or is this actually how things are? And does that mean that that even time and space and any kind of distance really doesn't exist at all except as illusory manifestations? Then we're really like, if we're not starting to really get disturbed by that idea, we're not, I think, really taking it in deeply. I think when it really starts to sink in, to say this whole universe, as all the scientists have described it, and everything I've known up to this point, is all just illusory delusion. That's, I think, where, you know, you could take it this far, but it still appears the way it appears according to very precise laws of dependent co-arising. But if we really open to, it's really not the way it appears, really not the way it appears, but it really appears like this, then the implications for our life and liberation are vast. I mean, if we really open to that reality, just think of what kinds of things that we're doing in our life that would start to seem like totally ridiculous. Right? It's like almost like there'd be no. I kind of feel like if I was in touch with this awareness all the time, there'd be no reason to do anything but just love everybody completely, and anything else would just be kind of extra. Even like practicing Zen, it would be a little bit, unless it kind of helped to open to this, would be sort of like, well, we don't even need to do that. It's just like, be the love that we all are, and if we get hungry, we can feed each other, and if we get sick, we can take care of each other.
We could save all beings.
Yes. So, thanks for your presence and attention and awareness today. Always enjoy discussing these things. with other sentient beings.